Last week, I think my dad was talking a bit about family likeness. He was preaching from Psalm 15 about how we're to imitate our Father in heaven by how we live. And I thought this morning I would start by picking up that same point, that even though we're back in the Beatitudes now in Matthew 5, we're dealing here with eight characteristics of family likeness within the family of God. Occasionally, people who know my dad will say to me, "You know, you remind me a lot of your dad. Your looks, your mannerisms, your way, you're different, but there is a certain likeness." And I never know what to say to that, because what do you say when someone tells you something you've really no control over whatsoever? I never decided to try to be like my dad. I would rather have kept my hair. But whether you like it or not, you get handed down certain characteristics. Per James. What hope has he of ever keeping his hair? Silly illustration, but the Beatitudes here in verses 1 to 12 are family characteristics. They're kind of like kingdom DNA. If you belong to Jesus, if you're part of his kingdom, then here are the distinguishing marks. They begin to show up in our lives. Eight characteristics of family likeness. You know, sometimes people read these verses and think that Jesus is really raising up a standard of merit to which we must attain, and they can feel crushed by these verses. The idea being that if you get like this, like the life described here, well, then you can enter the kingdom of heaven. But that's completely back to front. To stay with the illustration, my son James, for example, does not have to become like me before he can become my son. That's back to front, of course not. He is my son already, and because he's my son, he will, dear love him, inevitably share some family likeness and characteristics. And that's the kind of dynamic at work here in these verses. Jesus is saying, look, here's what happens when you belong to me. Here's how your life begins to change when you're my disciple. And it doesn't happen overnight. You know, you don't gain all the family characteristics in a flash. I didn't wake up one morning and think, wow, I had hair yesterday. It's a gradual thing. And in the same way, you don't suddenly take on the full beauty of the Beatitudes. Instead, these characteristics are born in us who believe in Jesus, but they take time to grow. And you don't even notice it happening. But rest assured, if you belong to Jesus, then the life described here in the Sermon on the Mount and encapsulated so well in the first 12 verses, this is your life and your future. And that's why every verse begins with the word blessed. It's to do with how much we're given. The favor of God that we don't deserve. We become poor in spirit, verse 3, God showing us that we've nothing to offer him but our sin. And yet we're given the kingdom of heaven. We're so blessed. We come to mourn for our sin and the misery in the world, verse 4, and yet we're comforted with the knowledge of God's forgiveness and how he will put right every wrong. We're so blessed. We become meek in verse 5, knowing that one day we'll inherit the earth through no merit of our own, and therefore why flap when things don't go our way here and now? We're so blessed. We start to hunger and thirst for righteousness, verse 6, knowing that we shall be filled. We're so blessed. We become merciful, verse 7, our text for today, knowing that God has heard and will continue to hear our own cries. We're so blessed. In every verse, it's the favor of God, the approval of God, the unmerited blessing of God on those who, quite frankly, deserve the opposite. And so we come to the fifth characteristic of belonging to Jesus. Merciful, verse 7. What is mercy? I remember when I was a teenager being with my grandparents one evening. They've gone now. They're in heaven now. But they were watching the evening news. And on the news came an all too familiar story of famine and starvation among people far away in another land. I've no idea what country it was. But it was horrible. And had I been in my own house, I almost certainly would have flicked it over. You know, flick the channel, because I don't, you know, you don't really want to watch that. I'd rather watch something more cheerful. But I remember being really struck by how much my grandparents were affected. And I just noticed they were so grieved. It grieved them in a way that I couldn't help but realize that it simply did not yet grieve me. They were visibly moved with compassion. Now, probably no one else would have thought anything of it, but I was thinking, I should really feel the same way. And yet I didn't. Frankly, my heart was hard. I mean, of course, it was sad. I didn't like, you know, I was sorry to see the plight of these poor people, but it came home to me that day that I was not yet merciful. I was not full of mercy. I wasn't moved with compassion to actually meet the needs of these people because I loved them. I hasten to add that in the Bible, mercy is not merely feeling compassion for those in need. Real mercy does indeed respond to the needs that you can see. It is compassion in action. And so, for example, in Luke chapter 11, we read that the Good Samaritan had mercy on the man. Remember the parable of the Good Samaritan? And he had mercy on the man. He fell into the hands of robbers. The man was stripped and beaten and left half dead. But the Good Samaritan went to him, bandaged his wounds, put the man on his own donkey, brought him to an inn, took care of him, paid for every expense. And that compassion in action is described in Luke 11 as mercy. So anytime we help the fallen, anytime we give to the poor, anytime we care for the sick, anytime we forgive someone, we're showing mercy. More than that, though, we're giving glimpses of what God is like. The whole way through the Bible, God reveals himself to be a God of mercy. You know, and right back in the story of the Exodus, we remember reading how the Israelites were groaning in their slavery in Egypt. And we read that God heard their cries. He was not deaf. He heard their cries. He was moved with compassion, choosing to save them. He is, and always is, in the scriptures towards his people, a merciful God, doing for his people what they could never do for themselves. That's mercy. But we need to think about, okay, well, that's what mercy is, but who are the merciful? Here in verse 7, who are like God. Who are the merciful? And we need to be careful here. The reformer Martin Luther talked about the danger of presumption, the danger of assuming that we are the merciful described in this verse simply because we do things at times that we like to think are merciful. But if you think about it, wouldn't that include basically everyone? I mean, pretty much everyone under the sun will at least occasionally do things which at least appear to be merciful, right? Are they all included in this verse? Are they all to assume that they are blessed and approved by God? Is the promise in the second half of the verse for anyone and everyone who has ever done any act of mercy? If we dare to think that, then the obvious question would be, well, how many acts of mercy do you think are needed to be included in this category of the merciful? And you see, that gets ridiculous. It's a completely wrong way of thinking. Note that it does not say, blessed are those who do acts of mercy. When I saw the plight of those people on TV in my grandparents' home, I might have decided to do some act of mercy to help, perhaps to alleviate my own conscience. But that would not have made me merciful. It says here, blessed are the merciful. The emphasis is on the character of the person, isn't it? It's about who you are. It's not simply about what you do. Yes. What kind of person are we? Are we merciful? Are we people who are full of mercy? Full of the love that moves us with compassion to serve? Even the mundane everyday stuff reveals that there is a big difference, isn't there, between merely doing some act of mercy and actually being full of mercy. There's a big difference, isn't there? I mean, if I walk into the kitchen near dinner time, I'm liable to be met by four or five different needs that all need attention right away. And, you know, the saucepan on the hob is bubbling over. James needs brought to the toilet 10 minutes ago. Jude is feeding Rory. Philippa wants help with whatever she's doing. The room needs tidied up. the table needs set, and all I can think of is, man, did I walk in at the wrong moment. Have you ever seen a basic need before you, and before you meet that need, you give a big sigh, and you adopt a stiff upper lip, and you think to yourself, right, let's get this over with. Because if so, then you know what I mean. There's a difference between merely doing some act of mercy externally on the outside, conforming to some expected pattern of behavior, and actually being merciful. There's a difference. It's very easy to do apparently compassionate things with dislike and out of compulsion. That's not being full of mercy. Religious people find it very easy to do good things that would appear to suggest that they are merciful people, when in fact they're not merciful at all. They just fear hell. And they reckon that if they do enough good things, then they'll manage to avoid it. Well, that's not being full of mercy. Or maybe they do things that may appear to be very mindful of the needs of others, when in fact they simply want heaven for themselves. And they reckon that if they try to be kind enough to enough needy people, they'll stack up enough credit to deserve a place there. That's not being full of mercy, that's just being self-interested. You know, we see the difference. Many people, religious and irreligious, do apparently merciful things, not because they're driven by a merciful heart, but because they covet the honor. They want the honor of being seen as merciful before men. They might get on Oprah or something and get to make a name for themselves as a do-gooder. But that's not being full of mercy. That's just being proud and full of yourself. Some people do apparently merciful things because they want to avoid the dishonor and the shame of not acting in a merciful way. But that's not being full of mercy. That's just trying to manipulate what people think of you. There's a difference. Other people simply want to feel good about themselves, isn't that right? And maybe this is the most common one of all. It's not that they want to be seen by others. They just want to believe that they're good people. They want to be proud of themselves. They want to say, yes, I did something. I did something worthwhile with my life. I have meaning. I have purpose. I did this. I made a difference. I'm a good person. I can sleep at night and feel good about my life. That's really nice. That's not being full of mercy. That's just you trying to feel good and searching for some meaning in your short life. Rest assured that these self-interested perversions are not what Jesus means by the merciful in this verse. It's not even true love. What does Paul say in 1 Corinthians 13? It's an incredible verse. It said, if I give all I possess to the poor and surrender my body to the flames, but have not love, I gain nothing. It's a reminder that people can indeed do the most extraordinary things for others, even die for them, and yet be void of true love. Such extraordinary sacrifice is not the fruit of a genuinely merciful heart. Only God knows the heart, of course. Only God can assess the motivations and the reasons that people do what they do. It is not for you and me to judge. But there's a difference, isn't there, between simply doing an act of extreme generosity and sacrifice and actually being moved with the mercy of God to love people because you love people, because he's put that love in your heart. True mercy is what we see in God. When God gave his one and only Son to die in our place, was he just doing the stiff upper lip thing? No. God wasn't thinking, well, I really can't stand these little vermin, but I guess I have to do what I have to do. That's what faithfulness and commitment is all about. No, that's certainly, most certainly not what faithfulness and commitment is all about, because it's void of love. The Father willingly gave up his one and only Son for us, as we see at this table again today. And the Son willingly laid down his life for us. Why? Because God so loved us and wanted us to share in his glory. The very heart of God burns with passionate love and mercy for his people. And therefore, he is full of mercy. not treating us as our sins deserve, but adopting us into his family because he loves us more than we've ever dreamed. We don't know what it is to be merciful until we've seen the mercy of God. We really don't. When Jesus said, "Blessed are the merciful," he means, blessed are those who are filled up and overflowing with the mercy of God. Blessed are those whose hearts have been touched and moved by the way in which God has treated them. You know, it's the staggering realization that we get again this morning around this table, that the blood of Jesus cleanses every filthy stain in my life and your life. That's what enables us to forgive those who have sinned against us. Or when we cannot pay the bills and we've no idea how we're going to manage, to then be bowled over by the way in which God mercifully provides for all our needs, that is what makes us more sensitive to the needs of others, so that we want to care for them as God has cared for us. Or when we're sick and suffering in some way, and then discover to our amazement that God sends help, either giving us strength to cope that we never thought we'd have, or giving us the ability not to worry, knowing that he's with us, or giving us people to look after us, or maybe even giving us healing that we did not expect. That is what produces mercy in us towards those who are sick and suffering. It's what God does for us that turns us outwards in love for others. It's not forced. It's not put on. It's not acting out of mere duty or expectation. It's not to feel good about ourselves. It's not the fruit of a warped self-interest. No, it's just a merciful heart, humbled by the mercy that we've known and experienced ourselves. You think of that great drama, Les Miserables, and the story, I think I've shared the illustration before. Everyone knows it, I think, pretty well. The story of Jean Valjean is a thief whose life has not changed even after 19 years in a French prison. He is given shelter by a kindly bishop, but then during the night he repays the kindness of the bishop by running off with the church silver. And when the police catch up with him and they drag him back to the bishop, and they're delighted to have caught this thief red-handed, the bishop says to him, "My son, you forgot the candlesticks. I wanted you to have these as well." What does that do to him? I mean, this is the message. What does that do to him? From that point on, his whole life has changed. He deserved condemnation, but instead received mercy. And from now on, his life is ruled more by gratitude than it is by greed. And even the inspector, who continues to mercilessly hunt him down, even he is shown mercy by the former convict. That's what mercy does. It touches your heart in a way that law and expectation and duty can never touch your heart. But when mercy touches your heart, it changes. It changes you. Are you gripped and shaped by the mercy of God to you in Christ crucified? You know, your life will actually tell it pretty well. One thing is for sure, we cannot be full of the mercy of God if we've never even seen it as our own lifeline. We cannot give what we have not received. So finally, what is the promise to the merciful? We've seen what mercy is. We've seen who the merciful are. What is the promise to the merciful? Answer, again. Again and again and again. We will be shown mercy. Having received it, we need it still, and will never be disappointed. As disciples of Christ, we never get to the end of God's mercy. We'll never outstretch it. We'll never exhaust it. We'll never cry out to God and be unheard. It's amazing that, you know, if you're in the park, there might be 50 other children there at the same time, and everyone's making a complete racket. You know, it could be you could be in the park with a crowd of people, loads of kids, all making a real din, really, really noisy. And yet somehow, no matter how many other children there are, parents have the ability to hear the voice of their own children's cry. Isn't that right? your ear is tuned in. You hear it. A parent's ears will prick up at the sound of their own child's cry. In the same way, the Lord knows His own. He knows us. He knows our needs. And whatever's going on with us, He hears our cries. He hears the cries of His children. He's attentive to our needs. And He will continue always to supply our need. That doesn't mean that life will be rosy, that we'll have no problems. But He is always there for us, giving us what we need. Tomorrow, the next day, the day after that, every day of our lives, we will never outgrow our dependence on the mercy of God. And as we sang earlier from Psalm 100, God's mercy is forever sure. Why? Because we're His. Simply because we're His. Simply because of His grace. To quote another song that we sang earlier with the children, He's known me, He's loved me since before the world began. How wonderful to be a part of God's amazing plan. From everlasting to everlasting, our Father in heaven is merciful to us. And if we ever doubt, and we do doubt, we only need to look at the cross. And that's why the sacrament of the Lord's Supper really matters. That's why we should not neglect it, because we need to be reminded that God's mercy is forever sure. As Paul says in Romans 8, if God is for us, who can be against us? He who did not spare His own Son, but graciously gave Him up for us all, how will He not also, along with Him, graciously give us all things? It's a good point. The last word then from Hebrews chapter 4, verse 16. Let us then approach the throne of grace with confidence, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in our time of need.